So this is work I've been doing with Dan Fried and Graham Siegel. And it's closely related to work I'm also doing with Dmitry Bielov. And an important precursor of what I'll be saying, for sure, is a paper by Gukov, Mangamani, and Witten, which is on the archive, 98-11-048. So an outline of the talk is the following. I'll give you a somewhat long-winded introduction. And then I'm going to give you a mini course on differential cohomology. And then I'll talk about quantization of generalized Maxwell theory. And the main result will be that electric and magnetic fluxes, suitably defined, don't commute. I'll first explain why you expect they should commute, and then I'll explain why they don't. And then there's a long story here, which I won't get close to the end of, so I'll just summarize the remainder of the story after I've explained the simplest version of the result. So fluxes and brains have been playing an important role in string theory for 10 years now. We had the anniversary of Joe's paper last week. And they continue to be very important, for example, in claims of moduli stabilization a la KKLT and in recent applications to string cosmology. But personally, I feel that the mathematics, the mathematical foundations of fluxes is not yet in a satisfactory state. And so I continue to think about some more foundational issues, the ones I'll talk about. This is pretty unfashionable, and so I want to start by defending myself by explaining why I think being a little more careful about the mathematics of fluxes can have an impact on physics. So I think that the kind of mathematics I'm going to be explaining will be useful to some of the following motivating questions. What's the Hilbert space for Ramon-Ramon fields? In particular, how do we describe the different flux sectors, topological sectors of Ramon-Ramon fields? And that's important if you're going to talk about the Hartle-Hawking wave function for fluxes. And you also need this kind of mathematics just in order to write the type 2a or the type 2b Ramon-Ramon action. It sounds incredible. But I believe it's true that nobody in the literature has actually written down the full action for the Ramon-Ramon fields, including the Chern-Simons term in an arbitrary, topologically non-trivial situation. But I'm sure, actually, from the work with Bielov, that it can be done with this kind of mathematics. Associated to these moduli stabilization problems, it's very important to know what is the partition function of the M5 brain. And of course, there's been a lot of work on this, but there are still things to understand. And this is the right kind of mathematics for discussing the correct Dirac quantization conditions on fluxes and for discussing tadpole constraints, and especially the torsion corrections to tadpole constraints. So we know in M theory there are torsion corrections to the tadpole constraints. The familiar tadpole constraint of 1/2 g wedge g is equal to i8, at least in Dirac cohomology. There are torsion corrections to that. We know that. And there should be important torsion corrections in type 2A and type 2B string theory and in orientifolds. And those haven't been worked out. I think there was a paper this morning on the net about that. And there are further issues in anomaly cancellation. For example, especially with B brains and orientifolds, where the kind of mathematics I'm going to be talking about is quite relevant. At times, I've even thought that these kinds of issues might put a significant cut on the landscape. And I'm not sure that's going to happen, but I still think that this will actually be useful in understanding flux compactifications. And we're going to be focusing in this talk just on this question right here. So since I won't get to explain all the details of the final result, let me state the final result. Yeah, that's certainly part of it. That is certainly part of it. And you see, but from my point of view, the type 2A string is, the Ramon-Ramon field in type 2A is just as self-dual as the type 2B, really. Well, there is a natural polarization in type 2A where you keep 0, 2, and 4 and throw out 6, 8, 10. Which is, and there's no natural splitting of the 5-form part in general. But the issues, the topological issues, are really there already for type 2A. Okay, so let me say what the end result is, and then I'll start to explain how we got there. So consider consider type 2 string theory on X times R, where X is a spatial 9-manifold. And then the Hilbert space of this theory can be decomposed into various flux sectors. And the question is, how do we describe those flux sectors? So for the first few years after Joe's paper, it was assumed that H was the direct sum over, let's say, type 2A string theory, to be specific, over H even of X. And for each set of even cohomologies, we had a flux sector. Then we realized, for various reasons, that that wasn't quite right. We should actually grade the Hilbert space by K theory, the K group being a different abelian group associated to the manifold. And that's what we've been assuming since then. But recently, with Dan Fried and Graham Siegel, we realized that that's also not right. And our basic observation even applies to Maxwell theory in 3 plus 1 dimensions. It applies to a general class of theories, which I call generalized abelian gauge theories. And these are gauge theories whose space of gauge inequivalent fields is a differential generalized cohomology theory. And the foundations of differential generalized cohomology can be found in a paper of Hopkins and Singer. Pardon?
What's the answer?
Well, that's what the seminar is all about. So,
can you just summarize?
I'm going to summarize it right now. So the story as we currently understand it is this. The Hilbert space is should be formulated as an irreducible representation of a certain Heisenberg group. And it can be decomposed into electric flux sectors and magnetic flux sectors. But the torsion components don't commute. And the fluxes are the characters of translations by flat fields and dual flat fields. and those flat fields and dual flat fields don't commute in this Heisenberg group. So that's the essence of it, and I'll explain that probably doesn't make a lot of sense to you. The point of the seminar is to make that make sense. And K of X encodes both electric and magnetic fluxes. And therefore, one cannot measure the entire K-theory class associated to a flux. And therefore, since D-brain source flux, you can't measure the entire K-theory class of a D-brain. And for me, this was conceptually very important, because what is our picture of a D-brain? Our picture of a D-brain is there's some submanifold of space-time with some stuff wrapping it and a vector bundle on that submanifold. But that's specifying an entire K-theory class. And what I'm saying is that can't actually be measured because of an uncertainty principle. And so I found it a bit of a shock that somehow that standard picture of a D-brain has to be modified by some quantum effects.
So what point is the role of H-bar in this picture?
Well, that's a very good question. And that's sort of the point, that for the torsion components, there is no tunable H-bar, and it survives, this quantum effect survives into large distance. I'll explain that at the very end of the talk. Okay. So now to explain how I got to this, I need to give this mini course on the mathematics of differential cohomology, which is something that I really think more physicists should learn about, because I think it's really the right language for talking about fluxes. Okay, one little thing before I get into that course, and that's the issue of torsion. What do I mean by torsion? I do not mean anything to do with a B field, okay, and nothing to do with a connection on the tangent bundle. What I mean is if G is an abelian group, then the torsion subgroup, which I'll denote G sub T, I'm told that usually people denote it that way, that's too much writing. So G sub T are the elements of finite order, the subgroup of elements of finite order. So do we have to worry about torsion? A lot of people don't want to think about torsion in flux compactifications. But any Calabi-Yau manifold with non-zero fundamental group, non-zero finite fundamental group, will have torsion in both its cohomology and in its K-theory. And here in this workshop, we've heard a lot about ADS-CFT duals of the type X5 times Y, where Y is a Sasaki-Einstein manifold. And in a lot of these are dual to four-dimensional conformal field theories. Had a lot of seminars about that in the sub-workshop that Ami has organized. And these Sasaki-Einstein manifolds will, in general, have torsion. Okay. So now I come to part two, the mini-course on differential cohomology. So our goal is to understand Ramon-Ramon fields. But to develop the basic ideas, I'm going to develop differential cohomology, not differential K-theory. The idea is that things are much more familiar with cohomology than K-theory, and the general structure that I'll explain carries over very simply into the K-theoretic case. So let's begin with the following paradigm, which is just Maxwell theory. And the question is, what is the space of gauge inequivalent fields? Okay, so let's just think about that for a second. Now, how would you answer that? I think a lot of you would say the following. Well, I have a line bundle L over space-time M. I have a connection on that line bundle, and it has a connection nabla, It has a field strength F. And then I would just say that the space of gauge and equivalent fields is the space of all connections on L divided by the gauge group, the group of maps into U1. Now, that's, of course, the space of gauge and equivalent fields in a given topological sector, because the line bundle has a fixed first Chern class. And in Maxwell theory, we, of course, like to sum over topological sectors. So we should probably do something like this. Take a union over two-dimensional cohomology classes. For each class, choose a line bundle, and then take that as our space of gauge and equivalent fields. But I'm going to explain another point of view, which is both more natural, which makes clear that this space is an infinite-dimensional abelian group, and most importantly for today, extends to higher degree field strengths. So the key remark is that all gauge invariant information is in the holonomy. Okay, so what's the holonomy? If my connection looks like D plus A locally, then if sigma is a closed one cycle, we're going to take that to the exponential of 2 pi I times the integral of A over sigma. Now, I want you to think for a fixed connection of the holonomy as a map from the set of all the group of all one cycles, closed one cycles on M, into the group U1. And of course, this is well defined, even if A is not globally well defined, as long as it's a connection. Now, this is a group homomorphism. If I take two closed one cycles and add them, their holonomy is the product. But it's not an arbitrary homomorphism. Supposing my closed one cycle sigma is the boundary of some manifold B, then we know that we can evaluate the holonomy on this one cycle by integrating over the bounding manifold a field strength F, where F is globally well defined. And so now we'll define H2 check of M to be the set of all homomorphisms which satisfy this property. In other words, we'll think of characterizing a line bundle with its connection up to isomorphism just by its holonomy function. And this is the same thing as this space over here. So this is how I want you to think about the space of gauge inequivalent fields in Maxwell theory. So let me give you an example. This is an example which will come up again and again in the talk. So let's take a Lens space, S3 mod ZK, with the ZK, say, in SU2. And then we know that there's a non-contractible cycle in that Lens space. But this non-contractible cycle has the property that K times this non-contractible cycle is 0. So we could define a line bundle with connection by saying that chi of sigma is equal to 1 if sigma is a boundary. If sigma is not a boundary, then it's homologous to some multiple of this. So it suffices to say what chi of gamma is. Now, because of this property here, that k times gamma is 0, it must be a kth root of unity. So let's suppose I take it to be omega k e to the 2 pi I over k. That defines for you a line bundle with a flat connection, which is topologically non-trivial. OK, so now the generalization is immediate. Pardon? Yes, this is an infinite dimensional abelian group because these are just homomorphisms between two abelian groups. So the So the generalization is the differential characters, also known as the Delaunay-Cheeger-Simons group of differential characters, which I'll denote by H check L of M, is the subgroup of homomorphisms from L minus 1 cycles on M, closed L minus 1 cycles on M into U1, which satisfy the property that there exists a field strength. That means that for all chi in H check L of M, if sigma, well, there exists an F sub chi, which is an L form on M, globally well-defined, such that if sigma is the boundary of B, then the holonomy on sigma is the integral around B of F. And now, by a generalized Maxwell theory, I mean a gauge theory such that the space of gauge inequivalent fields is H check L of M for some L. Are there any questions about that?
You want to say F is represents the integral
function. I'm coming to that. Right. That actually follows from what I said. Right.
Can you say anything about the 0-2 theory?
Eventually, I hope to say something about the 0-2 theory, but you're sort of light years ahead of where I am. As I was just saying in this kind of list of questions here, I think this is the right kind of mathematics for discussing things like the 0-2 theory in topologically non-trivial situations. That's why I think it's important for people to know it. Okay. One little piece of notation. This is an infinite dimensional abelian group, so we can think of it additively or multiplicatively. If I think of it multiplicatively, I use chi. If I think of it additively, I'll use the following notation, A check with brackets. What this is meant to suggest is the following. The A, you're supposed to think of the A as an L minus 1 form potential. But it's not globally well defined, necessarily. So that's why there's a check up there. The brackets are because I'm always discussing a class in here as a gauge equivalence class. Now, of course, we're sometimes interested in the case where A is globally well-defined. If A is an honest-to-God globally well-defined form, then we can define a differential character simply by writing exponential e to the 2 pi I integral on sigma of A. That's clearly a differential character. Now, you notice that the field strength is then D of A, and A being globally well-defined, the field strength is in the zero Durham cohomology class. And these are called topologically trivial characters, and I'll denote topologically trivial characters by brackets without a check on top. Okay, so let me come to Iz's point. Let's now try and get a picture of what this infinite dimensional abelian group looks like. So the first question is, what are the properties of the field strength? So I said to a chi, we get a field strength in omega L of M. And what do we know about it? Well, the first thing is, we know that if sigma bounds a B, then we can evaluate the holonomy on sigma by integrating over B. But I didn't tell you what B is. So I could change B to some B prime, just making a little deformation of B. And I have to get the same holonomy, and that implies that F is closed. Is that clear to everybody? Okay. On the other hand, I could have made a big change in B. I could have written B double prime, say, such that B union minus B double prime is some non-trivial closed L cycle in the manifold. still, I have to get the same holonomy. And that means, since chi of sigma is the same for B and B double prime, that implies that the field strength is an L form with integral periods. So this is my notation for closed L forms with integral periods. Anything with integral periods has to be closed. And if F is equal to 0, then we'll say that chi is flat. Okay. Now, there's gauging. You can't stop with just the field strength, although a lot of people do. There's gauge invariant information in a differential character, which is not encoded in just the field strength. For example, Wilson lines are a famous example. Those are topologically trivial flat fields, continuously tunable to 0. But there's further information, torsion information, in a differential character. And how do we see that? Well, it's the generalization of this lens space phenomenon. Supposing there's a cycle with sigma not 0, but k times sigma is a boundary. Okay, so how do we go about trying to evaluate chi of sigma? Well, we can't do it with just the field strength. What we know is that if we take this to the kth power, that's equal to the integral over b of the integral of f. Okay? From the basic defining property of differential characters, we know that. But there's an ambiguity in taking a kth root by a kth root of unity in saying what sigma, chi of sigma is. That extra information that we need in order to say what the holonomy is, the extra information is encoded in what I'll call the characteristic class, which is an integral cohomology class. And it allows us to take the kth root by writing exponential of 2 pi I, 1 over k, integral of f over b, minus a evaluated on b. This, you can check, is independent of choices. And the torsion information enters there in telling us how to take the kth root. So characters with a chi equals 0 are called topologically trivial. And those are the characters associated with a globally well-defined form, as I explained over here. OK. So let me stress this point, because it's often neglected in physics. As I said, torsion is the subgroup of elements of finite order. So if I have the integral cohomology group, it has a subgroup, which are the torsion classes. And the quotient is a lattice whose rank is the Betti number. Okay? So I'll denote the reduction modulo torsion by a bar. And there's a map from HL of MR, MZ, into HL of MR, whose kernel is the torsion subgroup, and the image is a full lattice in here. So again, with our example of our lens space, if H lower 1 of LK and Z is ZK, H lower 2 is 0, there are no non-trivial 2 cycles. That's the homology. The cohomology is the other way around. H upper 1 is 0, H upper 2 of LK and Z is ZK. So in this case, the cohomology is all torsion. In which what?
Which involves an infinite dimension.
Which, where what involves an infinite dimension?
H,
as I hope will become clearer, this H-check is always an infinite dimensional group on a finite dimensional manifold. I hope that will become clear in a moment. I'll explain it for a general manifold, and you'll see the structure. So it will involve, what is H-check 2 of L? It's the space of all line bundles with connection up to isomorphism. So as I explained here, you have an infinite dimensional space of connections on line bundles, modulo gauge equivalence classes. That's clearly an infinite dimensional space, all possible connections. So that's infinite dimensional. That applies to any manifold.
In other words, you could summarize it by saying that it's grouped with elements, not triples, in this Hopkins-Singer language, right?
Well, there is that Hopkins-Singer language, but I'm not going to need cocycles. I'm just going to need gauge inequivalent, gauge invariant information for this talk.
But still we're talking about the same group.
So exactly the same thing is what they're talking about. Isomorphism classes of their cocycles is that what I'm talking about. Okay, so now we have two maps here. We have what we could call a field strength map. Call that F to closed forms with integral periods. And we have, let's call it the characteristic class map to integral cohomology. Now these two are not independent pieces of data. They satisfy a compatibility condition. You see, I can take the characteristic class and I can reduce it modulo torsion. And so that gives me something in HL of MR. On the other hand, I can take the field strength, and because it's closed, I can take its Durham cohomology class. And these have to agree. Well, they do agree because they come from the same differential character. So we have this compatibility condition. And now we're not quite done with understanding what this space looks like, because there's still gauge invariant information which is not captured by the characteristic class and not captured by the field strength, and those are the Wilson lines. So if you have something which is topologically trivial and flat, that's what I mean by definition, that's a Wilson line. And so that takes, well, it's topologically trivial, so it's of that form. So it looks like this, where A is globally well-defined, and moreover, it's flat, so dA equals 0. So what is the space of Wilson lines? I'll denote it by WL minus 1 of M. And you see it's all closed L minus 1 forms, modulo something. If I shift A by a L minus 1 form with integer periods, then the holonomy does not change. So it's modulo L minus 1 forms with integral periods. And this is a finite dimensional torus. For example, by the Hodge decomposition, you can write this as the harmonic forms on M divided by the harmonic forms with integral periods. And so this is a torus of, this is a connected torus of dimension B sub L minus 1. Too silent. I mean, people, I'm not getting enough questions. Example. Lens space.
Sorry, I'm asking, say it again, what's H here?
These are H, curly H of the harmonic form. So another way of writing this, I mean, it depends how you want to think about this infinite dimensional torus. Another way of thinking about this is that this is real cohomology, modulo the full lattice. So the point is that this is just a connected torus. Okay, so so now I've told you all of the gauge invariant information in a differential cohomology class. There's the field strength, the characteristic class, and it's Wilson lines. But how is it all put together? Well, that's summarized by two very beautiful exact sequences. The first is the field strength exact sequence. So the kernel of this map, the space of all flat fields, looks like HL minus 1 with R mod Z coefficients. And let's understand that a little bit. So the flat fields is this group here. And this is equal to a sum of tori. Okay, so it looks like this. Where each torus is a torsor, well, each torus is a principal homogeneous space for the group of topologically trivial flat fields. So so this is a compact abelian group. So there's an identity element. So the connected component of the identity is this group here, and then there are a bunch of components, and the components are labeled by the torsion part of the cohomology 1 degree higher. That's not obvious. I'm simply telling you the answer. So that is to say that the flat fields sit in an exact sequence that looks like this. Okay, example, we can again take the Lend space. So let's take M is to be the Lend space, so L is equal to 2. So then there's only torsion in the cohomology. H1 is 0, so the Wilson lines are trivial. H2 of M is all torsion. This is E mod K. And so from this exact sequence here, the flat fields is just a copy of Z mod K. And what are those flat fields? Well, here I've already told you one of them. I characterized it by its holonomy. So these guys here, let's call them chi sub r of gamma, are simply the rth powers. So by specifying that as the holonomy, I've told you what the flat field is. And so there's a Z mod K group of flat fields. These are topologically non-trivial but flat. Sure. So, I mean, just whenever... So remember, what is W? W is HL minus 1 of MR. Well, better to say, W is a torus of dimension B sub L minus 1. So whenever that Betti number is not 0, okay, you'll have a torus. And I don't know, if you take something like a product of two Lend spaces, and you look at H3 of this with R mod Z coefficients, what you'll find is a torus, a non-trivial torus, two-dimensional non-trivial torus for its connected component of the identity, and then there'll be K components. You see, the Betty number, the third Betty number of this is 2. Okay? So this is a two-dimensional torus. And then because of the torsion and the cohomology of L, there'll be K components. So that's what the group of flat fields would look like for this case. This would be relevant to the M theory 3 form for M theory on a product of Lens spaces times some other stuff. Okay. So that's the flat fields. So now the second exact sequence, let's put it over here, is the characteristic class sequence. So we have this group, and we can map it to its characteristic class. And the quotient is the set of all topologically trivial fields. But what are those? Well, at first you think those are just L minus 1 form potentials. But then you see, if you look at this holonomy here, it's unchanged if I shift A by a closed form with integral periods. So since this is the space of gauge inequivalent data, here I should divide by L minus 1 of M with integer periods. And so that's the second exact sequence. So this shift, A goes to A plus omega, which is what I'm dividing out by, is the standard form of gauge transformations in a theory of L-form fields. So omega here is closed with integral periods. If omega were exact, you would all recognize A plus D lambda as the gauge transformation of an L minus 1 form field. The correct way to incorporate the globally non-trivial gauge transformations is to include an omega which has integer periods. Okay, so what does this space look like, the topologically trivial fields? Well, we can take omega L minus 1 mod L minus 1 Z. We can divide that by omega L minus 1 mod omega L minus 1 all closed fields. And the kernel is closed fields modulo closed fields with integer periods. And now this is an infinite dimensional vector space. For example, if I introduce a metric, this would be isomorphic to the image of D dagger by the Hodge decomposition. And this is our friend, the Wilson lines. So connected torus of dimension DL minus 1. OK, so now I've gotten to the first goal, which is to have what I hope is a very clear picture of what this space of gauge and equivalent fields looks like. It's an infinite dimensional abelian group, as I keep saying. So it's got an infinite dimensional vector space here. Let's consider the connected component of the identity. There's an infinite dimensional vector space. And then over that, there's a finite dimensional torus. So this torus is, if you like, U1 to the B sub L minus 1. And then there are a bunch of components that all look like this. So if I consider the vertical direction to be labeled by the group of components, HL of M with integer coefficients, the possible characteristic classes, then this simply repeats itself. Well, if the Betty number is non-zero, repeats itself according to a lattice. But of course, as I've said, this also has torsion information, so I would also get finite number of copies for the finite torsion group. So that's the basic picture you should have of what H check of L looks like. So let me now give one more example. Let's consider just H check 1 of M. So So what is that? Well, my definition is still up here. So H-check 1 of M goes from 0 cycles into U1. It's a homomorphism from 0 cycles into U1. What's a 0 cycle? A 0 cycle is a point. So it's a U1 valued function. And moreover, there has to be a field strength, so it's a differentiable function. So this is the set of all differentiable maps F from M into U1. And what's the characteristic class associated to this differential character? Well, it's just the pullback of the fundamental class on U1. And what's the field strength? Well, that's just 1 over 2 pi I d of the logarithm of F, which is well defined. And you can see that these are compatible. The cohomology class of this is exactly that. There's a significant special case of this. Let's suppose we consider M itself to be a circle. So that's differentiable maps from S1 into S1. That's known as a periodic scalar field, or if you like, the loop group of U1. So this is the loop group of U1, or the Gaussian model on a circle. And supposing we have a field phi in here, then we all know that we can write that field as a constant mode plus a winding mode plus a bunch of oscillators. That's exactly this decomposition we see here. We're decomposing H-check 1 of S1 into the constant modes, that's just a copy of S1, times the winding modes, that's a copy of Z, times the oscillators, that's an infinite dimensional vector space. So these are the oscillators, these are the constant maps, and the component up here, up and down here, is the winding mode. And what I'm telling you is a generalization of that to all higher degrees. So, some other examples of where we encounter this question?
I thought one of your parameters in that left diagram was the order of torsion.
Well, there's no torsion in this particular case.
Why do we have two factors then?
These are the topologically trivial in flat. They're just the constant modes. Okay, so the map is just from the circle to a single face. So that's a circle. Okay. Then we have the winding node. W is an integer. Sigma is identified with sigma plus 1. Okay, so that's the component. And then we have the oscillators. And those are the loops which admit a logarithm. And that's an infinite dimensional vector space. Other questions? Okay, so other examples. A second example, as I've explained, is that H-check 2 of M is the group of isomorphism classes of line bundles with a connection. In other words, gauge inequivalent fields in Maxwell theory. H-3-check of M, that's the classes of B fields, at least in type 2. And finally, H4 check of M comes up because that's differences of C fields in M theory. Okay, now I want to next explain the main theorem about this differential cohomology group, which is Poincaré duality. Okay, so the first thing is that there is a very subtle product. Yeah. The 5-form in type 2B, well, before we understood about K-theory, people would have said that the 5-form in type 2B would be H-check 5 of M, and then you'd have to discuss a self-duality constraint. And jumping ahead, an important part of our story is, in general, how you can impose this interesting self-duality constraint and formulate the self-dual field for H2K plus 1 of M in 4K plus 2 dimensions. And one of the nice things about the formalism I'm explaining to you is that it gives you a very crisp way of saying what is the Hilbert space of a self-dual field. It's one of our main results. I'll indicate that very briefly at the end. That's how you would have said it if you modeled the phi form on differential cohomology. However, we now think that the type 2B field should be expressed in terms of differential K theory. And so it's part of that story. And again, I won't get to it, but there's a very similar picture for differential K theory of a manifold. That's why I'm explaining it in differential cohomology, because a lot of the notions are quite similar. Okay, so I want to get to Poincaré duality now. So there's a very subtle product on these differential characters. Which I'll denote as A1 check star A2 check. Thank you. Yeah, so it preserves the degree. And it's very subtle to define, so I'm not going to define it, but I will tell you some of the key properties. So the first key property is that the field strengths and the characteristic classes behave in the following simple way. But saying what the holonomy of the product is rather tricky. However, there's an important special case where it is easy to say what the holonomy is. So if A1 check is topologically trivial, so that means that A1 is 0, then we can say something nice about A1 star A2 check. Now you see from this property here, the product is topologically trivial. That means that it has to be given by some globally well-defined potential field. Okay? Of the potential has to be of degree L1 plus L2 minus 1. What is there? There's only one game in town. It's got to be A1 wedge F2. And that's true. Okay? In particular, notice that if I take a product of two topologically trivial fields, I get A1 dA2. Kind of nice. In particular, something I'll use in a moment, is that the product of two topologically trivial and flat fields is equal to 0. Okay, so that's the product. Now there's also a notion of an integral. Okay, so supposing the dimension of our manifold is n, and it's compact and oriented. Then there's an integral, a notion of integral, which I'll denote, integral h-check, which takes h-check n plus 1 of m to r mod z. And what it is here you have an n-form potential, so you take the holonomy of that potential around the manifold. You don't integrate the field strength. You couldn't do that. The field strength has the wrong degree. You take the holonomy around the manifold. So, for example, if I integrate h-check around a circle, and I'm taking h-check 2 of S1 to r mod z, what would that be? Well, what is the second degree 2 differential cohomology? It's a line bundle with connection. So if I have a line bundle with connection on a circle, what I can do is I can take the logarithm of the holonomy and divide by 1 over 2 pi I, and that's what this integral is. It's the holonomy around the circle. So that brings me to Poincaré duality. Okay, so theorem. M is again compact and oriented of dimension n. Then we have a perfect pairing on h-check L of M times h-check n plus 1 minus L of M into R mod Z. So notice that the degrees here add up to 1 more than the dimension of the manifold, and the pairing is just multiply and integrate in that sense. And perfect means that every homomorphism from here into here is given by pairing with an element of here. I'm skating over some analytical subtleties with delta functions and so on, but this is good enough for us. Okay, so it's worth understanding why this is true as an application of what we saw before. So let's just see why this is true. So I told you that there are two exact sequences. There's the first, the field strength exact sequence, whose kernel is the flat fields. And then for the dual group, I'll write the characteristic class exact sequence. So that goes to h n plus 1 minus L of mz. And the kernel here is the topologically trivial fields. And now you can see, think of as an exact sequence, think of it roughly as this group is this group plus this group, okay? Then this pairs with this. That's the standard perfect pairing that you find in topology textbooks. Okay, so that's a perfect pairing, and that's of finite dimensional abelian groups, and that's proved in to be a perfect pairing in topology textbooks. So we have a pairing of this with this. So the characteristic class of one pairs with the flat component of the other. And then we have these infinite dimensional pieces, and the pairing there is also very explicit. If I have F in here and a dual gauge potential in here, then the pairing of F and A dual is simply, again, multiply and integrate modulo Z in the usual sense. That's well defined. You can check because I'm dividing out by this, and you can also check that that's a perfect pairing. So let me make a little remark here. So for the case of the Lens space, we'll certainly be meeting that later, so let me do it now. So for the case of the Lens space, we have H check 2 of LK times H check 2 of LK goes to R mod Z. And this is what's known as this is what's known as the linking pairing. So if you have how shall we think of it? Well, we're really only interested in this case, in the pairing between the flat fields and the characteristic classes. And if I used Poincaré duality to say that I'm multiplying two characteristic classes, H2 of LKZ times H2 of LKZ into R mod Z, then what I would do is I would take the Poincaré dual of this guy, and some multiple of it would bound a disk, and then I would intersect that disk, I would evaluate that disk on this guy, and divide by the multiple I had to get to make it bounding, and then raise that to the 2 pi I over k. Okay. So, put more simply, that ends up being the perfect pairing on zk times zk, which in fact goes into U1, which looks like this: R, comma S goes to e to the 2 pi I R times S over k. That's exactly what that pairing is. Okay. So,
sorry, Greg.
Yeah.
I'm taking notes, sorry, from garbage to talk to you. So what is AD?
Oh. Okay. So I'm trying to explain what this pairing looks like in very concrete terms. So I'm saying that you should think of this group, the pairing between these two infinite dimensional groups, as the pairing between this part and this part. That's the standard multiply and integrate. And the pairing between the field strength here and the topologically trivial fields here. So choose your favorite field strength here, F, and choose some globally well-defined L minus 1 form potential here. Really, it's equivalence class, but it won't matter. Okay? And I'm telling you what the pairing looks like. It's this pairing.
Okay, so from our adjustment station, there's no duality going on.
Well, the deep duality is this right here. Well, because, I'm not giving you a rigorous proof, but I'm giving you an indication of why that's true. So this with this is a perfect pairing, and this with this is also a perfect pairing. You're saying, why is this a perfect pairing?
No, I'm asking, shall I think of a dual AD denoted here as just a notation, or really a dual field strength?
No, it really is. Okay, I'm coming to that. I'm almost done with my math lesson. And then I'll start talking about generalized Maxwell theory. the short answer is yes. You should think of that as the electromagnetic dual potential. The notation is meant to suggest that, and that's indeed where I'm going. Okay, I just want to make one more remark about this pairing, and that's about Chern-Simons terms. So supposing that the manifold is odd-dimensional, and supposing we have a class in H-check P of M, then we can consider the integral of H-check star H-check, and that's in R mod Z. Now, it's still on the board. I told you what this product was for topologically trivial fields. So you see, that's just the integral of ADA for topologically trivial fields. So we recognize, and this is the generalization to topologically non-trivial fields, so we recognize that this is a Chern-Simons term. All right? Now, I want to make a comment about this, because in the physics literature, we of course encounter ADA and supergravity actions and things like that, and then we need to define it for topologically non-trivial fields. And what people often say is, well, you take your manifold, here's your manifold M, you extend it to some manifold Z, you extend the field strength to some field strength F tilde on Z, and you integrate over Z, F tilde wedge F tilde. That's really not a satisfactory definition. First of all, it can happen that there is no extension for topological reasons. But even if there's an extension, it's not satisfactory. Because you can modify this F tilde by adding to it a compactly supported form which is non-zero in cohomology and restricts to zero on the boundary. So you could take F tilde goes to F tilde plus alpha, where alpha has compact support and yet has non-zero periods. And that will continuously change the value of this integral. Okay? But this is intrinsically defined. I didn't tell you how to define that product, but it can be defined intrinsically on M, and so the Chern-Simons term really has to be defined this way. Just as an example, going back to my periodic scalar field, let's consider H check 1 of S1. Let's consider phi 1 and phi 2, which go from S1 to U1. What would the product be? Well, it turns out that the product is the following. You take phi, you take its logarithm. That's 2 pi I. Let's call it straight phi. So straight phi satisfies phi of x plus 1 is phi of x plus w, where w is the winding number.
So this would be fine if we restrict it to flat field, right? And then do the same thing.
Which here?
Then this extension to dimensional z on the atomic mass shell.
No. Nothing about flat.
No, but then that shell would be constant. You couldn't change it continuously.
Ah, you can change it continuously because z is a manifold with boundary.
No, but you say it's if it's compactly supported, right?
If it's compactly supported, yeah. Oh, yeah, I can. So let's let M be some x times S1. Let's let Z be x times a disk. Okay. Let's put a bump form on the center of the disk. It will pair with some it will pair non-trivially with something else on the other side. I'll show you later. This is not a satisfactory definition. The correct thing to say is that you extend the entire differential character as a differential character over the bounding manifold. And then if you take the field strength of that differential character, you can do this. So that's why it's okay for gauge theory, because in gauge theory, what you're really doing is you extend the gauge potential and the line bundle. And then you take the field strength of that. But, well, we work with three forms and four forms. Okay, so back to the periodic scalar field. So there's a nice formula for this, but I just want to write it out to show you that it's not obvious to say what this is. In particular, if the winding number is zero, there would be an obstruction in this case, even to extending it. And so the formula is this one. This part is obvious from what I've said here. But then there's a non-obvious part, which is the winding number of 1 times the value of 2 at 0. And you wouldn't be able to get that using the extend by field strength type definition. Okay, so finally I come to some physics. That's the end of the math lesson. But I want to keep this picture here because that picture is crucial to what I'm going to say. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the Hamiltonian formulation. Of generalized Maxwell theory. Okay, so now our space-time of dimension n is space x times time. Our gauge fields are in H check L of M. Our action is just pi r squared f star f. Nothing fancy. What could be simpler? And our Hilbert space, well, you know, the phase space is just the cotangent bundle of the space of fields on a spatial slice, so that's phase space. And so the Hilbert space is just L2 functions on h check L of x. Okay? Perfectly standard. Now, let's think about what flux sectors are. On the one hand, we can grade our Hilbert space by magnetic flux sectors. So M here runs over this cohomology group, HL, of space with Z coefficients. And why is that? Because a typical wave function here, say psi, denoted psi of a chick, could have support on some definite component. So I would say that if my wave function had support on this component, then I'm in the nth topological flux sector. For example, in Maxwell theory, M would be the first Chern class on the line bundle. On the other hand, as Sergei was anticipating, there's electromagnetic duality. So there's an equivalent theory which is formulated in terms of H check dual in H check n minus L of space-time. And it's equivalent as long as the dual radius, if you like, satisfies the t-duality relation. I'm not putting h bar to 0, to 1 in this talk. Anyway, because there's an electromagnetic dual theory, there's also a grading of the form of electric flux, which, if you like, is just the component where the dual wave function has its support. I'll give you another way of thinking of electric flux in just a moment. But now we come to the question, okay, we can decompose our Hilbert space into electric and magnetic flux sectors. Can we simultaneously decompose our Hilbert space into electric and magnetic flux sectors? Can we simultaneously measure the electric and magnetic fluxes? Yes?
Sorry, again, so what is R and
L rule
and H bar here?
Well, H bar is just H bar. R is defined here. Okay. So the field strength has integer periods. Okay. So in the dual theory, there will be S dual, which is pi R dual squared, integral of F dual star F dual. And then the usual Legendre transformation, or the Hamiltonian formulation, if you like, will give you equivalence if you have that t-duality relation. Okay, so now we come to this question. Can we simultaneously measure the electric and magnetic fluxes? So your natural response to this question should be, of course, yes. Obviously, yes. If we think about the Gaussian model, the decomposition into electric and magnetic flux sectors is the decomposition into winding number and momentum sectors. And we know very well that you can simultaneously write down winding and momentum for the periodic scalar field. More generally, how would you measure magnetic flux? Well, you would say, let me take some L cycle on space, and I would measure the magnetic flux by integrating F over that L cycle. Or you might take an N minus L cycle on X, and you would integrate star F over the N minus L cycle, and you would call that the electric flux. And so in the quantum theory, do these commute? Well, let's see. So from this action, we easily see that the momentum pi conjugate to A is just the Hodge dual of F. So the integral on sigma 1 of F commuted with the integral on sigma 2 of star F is proportional to the integral on sigma 1 of F, the integral on sigma 2 of pi sigma 1 and sigma 2 are closed cycles, so I can introduce Poincaré duals, omega 1 and omega 2. And now, pi commutator A is a delta function, just the standard commutation relations. So this is just the integral with an h bar here of omega 1 d omega 2. But omega 1 and omega 2 are Poincaré duals. These are closed forms. This is 0. No problem. You can simultaneously measure those operators. Where's the problem? The problem is that these only measure the topological sector modulo torsion. Because you see, if you imagine you tried to get a torsion component out of this, n times this would be 0. But n times a real number equals 0 means the real number is 0. You're just not going to measure any torsion from these integrals. And these abelian groups, in general, have torsion subgroups, as I was stressing before. So we need to do better to see whether electric and magnetic fluxes can be simultaneously measured. And to do better, we have to do better in understanding what this decomposition is. What is it? What is electric flux anyway? Not in terms of the dual gauge field, but in terms of the original gauge field A. So the key to understanding that is that star F is the same thing as the momentum, and the momentum is the infinitesimal generator of translations. So we're trying to diagonalize, when we diagonalize electric flux, we're trying to diagonalize the translation operator. So let me give you a definition. A state of definite electric flux, let's call it E check, is a translation eigenstate. Meaning, for all phi check and h check L of x, psi of a check plus phi check is the exponential of 2 pi I times the integral on h check of e check star phi check times psi of a check. In other words, a momentum eigenstate. Right? A momentum eigenstate is something which, when you translate it, it just turns into a phase times itself. Now, we're not actually interested in states of definite electric flux. We're interested in states of definite topological class of electric flux. Okay? Now, because of the way the Poincaré duality works, as I explained before, E1 check is continuously connected to E2 check if and only if they have the same characteristic class. But the characteristic classes paired with the flat fields. So this is if and only if E1 check phi F check equals E2 check phi F check for all flat fields. Okay, so what we're really after here is that a state of definite topological class of electric flux is a translation eigenstate for all flat fields. So I'm just asking that if I translate by a flat field, then I transform by a phase, and then this phase becomes simply the integral of E phi F, where E is an Hn minus L of xz. So that's the definition of being in a state of definite electric flux. It means that if you translate by the group of flat fields, your wave function transforms by phase. Any questions about that? That's a key point. Okay, well, now we're able to see the non-commutativity. So, decomposing the Hilbert space with respect to electric flux is diagonalizing translation by flat fields. So now, supposing a wave function is in a definite state of magnetic flux. So that means its support is in a definite component here. And supposing that there are topologically non-trivial flat fields, translation by a topologically non-trivial flat field would take you from one component to another. But to be in a state of definite electric flux is to be in a block wave under translation by the all flat fields, including the topologically non-trivial flat fields. So it's clear that the two things can't possibly be simultaneously satisfied. So again, if we consider our lens space, then the space of components is ZK. So a definite magnetic flux, so think of this as the space of components. So to be in a state of definite magnetic flux is to have your wave function supported in a definite component. But the flat fields is another copy of ZK. And to be in its definite state of electric flux is to have a definite phase under marching along by a ZK phase. So clearly you can't have this two things simultaneously. OK, so now there's a better way of looking at this. Which is a group theoretic approach. So let's just take a step back and make the following observation. Let S be any abelian group. And consider the Hilbert space of L2 functions on S. Then, first of all, this is a representation of S. Right? Because for any S naught in S, there's a translation operator which translates S by S naught. This is also a representation of the Pontryagin dual group, S hat. That's the group of characters into U1. Because for all chi in S hat, we have the multiplication operator given by this. So H, the Hilbert space, is a representation of S and S hat, but it is not a representation of the product S times S hat. And why not? Because you can easily check, a simple one-line calculation shows you that these operators don't commute. They commute up to multiplication by a C number, which is just chi of S naught. That's a one-line calculation. So the interpretation of, So the interpretation of this formula here is that H is a representation of a Heisenberg extension of S times S hat. And moreover, a nice fact about Heisenberg groups is that by the Stone von Neumann theorem, a Heisenberg group has a unique irreducible representation. So now let's apply this general fact to S, which is the differential cohomology group, H check L of X. Its Pontryagin dual group by Poincaré duality is H check N minus L of X. Okay, so we can say that the Hilbert space of this theory is the unique irrep of this Heisenberg group. Maybe I should write down the group commutator. So the group commutator here is the following. If I have A1 check, I'm going to not write this, the square brackets. A1 check dual, A2 check dual, that's equal to the exponential of 2 pi I times A2 check, A1 check dual minus A1 check, A2 check dual. So that's the commutator, and that characterizes the Heisenberg group up to isomorphism. Okay, so now we're able to understand much more deeply the fact that the electric and magnetic fluxes don't commute. Because electric flux is the characters that we get by diagonalizing the flat fields, H L minus 1 of X R mod Z. And the magnetic flux is by diagonalizing the dual flat fields. Now let me remind you that the flat fields, as I explained before, is a sum of connected tori. The connected tori were the Wilson lines, and the non-zero components was the torsion subgroup. Okay, so inside this Heisenberg group, we have the flat fields and the dual flat fields. So the Wilson lines, first of all, the Wilson lines and the dual Wilson lines, those are topologically trivial. And I told you that the product of topologically trivial and flat is zero. So WL minus 1 and WN minus L minus 1 commute. They can be simultaneously diagonalized. And their characters, the characters of this, is HN minus L of XZ modulo torsion. The characters of this is H bar L of XZ modulo torsion. And therefore, we can simultaneously diagonalize the Hilbert space of fluxes modulo torsion, in complete accord with this argument here. There was nothing wrong with this argument. However, because the pairing is trivial on the Wilson lines, it descends to a pairing on the torsion part, on the topologically non-trivial flat fields. So the pairing on H L minus 1 with R mod Z times H N minus L minus 1 with R mod Z descends to the pairing on H L torsion times H N minus L torsion to R mod Z. And this is a perfect pairing. In other words, they don't commute, and they maximally don't commute. So the Hilbert space, okay, so if I decompose the Hilbert space in terms of E bar and M bar, electric and magnetic fluxes modulo torsion, then on H0 bar, 0 bar, there will be a finite Heisenberg group that acts here, which is the Heisenberg extension of this product of groups. So let me give you the Lens space example of that. So every homomorphism of this into this is given by pairing with something in here. Okay, so let's take X to be the lens space. Okay, so then the flat fields is a ZK, is all torsion. So this decomposition here simply becomes, well, it's not interesting. There's no interesting torsion, non-torsion information. And on the other hand, there's this here is a Heisenberg group extension of the flat fields and the dual flat fields, which acts on this space. And this Heisenberg has a unique irreducible representation, which is just the familiar clock and shift operators. So we have P, which is K by K, and Q, which is K by K, with PQ equals omega K QP. Or put differently, so diagonalizing electric or magnetic fluxes is diagonalizing P or Q. Or put differently, the electric fluxes are 1 over the square root of K times the sum of e to the 2 pi I e m over k times the magnetic fluxes. No, sum over m. Yeah?
I think maybe I missed something. Like, so this torsion, how is it observable? Does the flux, the way I would usually find it, you say it doesn't matter?
Good. So that's the way you're going to observe this, or you could observe this in principle, is let's consider Maxwell theory, say, Maxwell on a lens space times time. And now what we do is we take the, we say, we slowly transport an electron around the non-trivial cycle and let it combine with another electron, let it interfere with another electron. And we'll measure the Aharonov-Bohm phase. Measuring that Aharonov-Bohm phase measures the magnetic flux and, in fact, puts the universe in a definite state of magnetic flux. And so the prediction here is that if you do that, and then slowly transport a magnetic monopole around this cycle, you would find, with probability 1 over k, all of the k possible Aharonov-Bohm phases for the electric flux. Okay, so let me finish up here. Okay, so I want to make just one remark about the semi-classical limit, coming back to something that Sergei brought up at the beginning. And that is, for the non-torsion parts of F, you can take a semi-classical limit. You can take H bar goes to 0 by taking a large volume if L is less than 2L is less than n. And the reason is that our action over H bar looks like this, pi r squared f star f. If we make a conformal scaling of the metric, this goes to omega to the n minus 2L over H bar. Okay, so we can make H bar as small as we like by scaling up the metric. But so that H bar is continuously tunable. But in this torsion pairing, there's no continuously tunable H bar. So you can so there's a quantum effect. So this is a quantum effect that doesn't vanish at large volume. Okay, so for the few survivors, let me summarize in a few minutes what the rest of the story is like. So I've just explained this for the simplest case of generalized Maxwell theory. Well, the first thing to say is that this now allows you to say something about the self-dual field. So in the case of the non-self-dual field, I characterize the Hilbert space as the unique irreducible representation of the Heisenberg group H-check L of X times H-check N minus L of X. Now, one of the nice things about this formulation is that it's manifestly self-dual. I didn't have to make any choice of which polarization I'm choosing. Okay, now if N is equal to 2P and H-check is an H-check P, then we can put a self-duality condition on the field string. Plus or minus. And then we think of this as the field strength and as the potential and the dual potential degrees of freedom. We want to cut this down by half. There exists a Heisenberg extension of H check P of X. You see, there's a perfect pairing, H check P of X times H check P of X. U1, which is what I explained before, the Chern-Simons term. And you can use that to define a Heisenberg group on just one copy here. And then, by the general theory of Heisenberg groups, it has a unique irreducible representation. So the unique IRREP is equal to the Hilbert space of the self-dual field. So that gives you a very crisp way of saying what the Hilbert space of a self-dual field is.
So where did you use the metric?
Well, I'll certainly use the metric when I write down the Hamiltonian. And of course, this is supposed to be conformally invariant, so I'm not quite sure what aspect of the metric you're asking about.
Yeah, but I thought that imposing self-duality on F needs some metric.
Yeah, sure. So there's the Hodge star right here.
Oh, but your construction of the Heisenberg group doesn't depend on the metric.
It will if the construction will depend, especially, let's see, if I write down representations of the Heisenberg group, I'll definitely need to use the metric. Okay, so.
So did you construct, is there a construction is Heisenberg group for some of the cases
of Hitler's? Yes. In particular for the self-dual, for the scalar, the self-dual scalar field, also known as the free fermion, this is already non-trivial. But this is another seminar. Okay, so, and so then the last thing to say is that in the Ramon-Ramon field of type 2, we have to use differential K theory of X. Now, differential K theory is very similar. It has the same picture. There's the infinite dimensional space of topologically trivial Ramon-Ramon fields. Those would be, for example, in the type 2A theory, all the odd forms. Then there's a finite dimensional torus of flat fields. And then the components is just the K theory group. And a lot of what I've said just goes through straightforwardly. Again, you form a Heisenberg extension of K-check of X and Hilbert space of the Ramon-Ramon field. of the Ramon-Ramon field is equal to the unique irreducible representation. And once again, the grading by K-theory, the grading by the K-theory class is diagonalizing the flat fields, which are, say, in type 2A theory, this group. And exactly as in this case over here, the different components of this don't commute in the Heisenberg group. And that's what forbids you from measuring exactly the K-theory class of the flux. And that's how you get the result I explained at the beginning. But you can't measure the K-theory class of the flux. And so that means, in particular, that there's something that has to change in our picture of the B-brain. So thanks for your patience.